Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising. This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 24th of July, these are our main stories. EU leaders have warned of challenging times ahead as Boris Johnson prepares to become the new British Prime Minister and vows to deliver Brexit by the 31st of October. He also faces difficulties within his own Conservative Party.
I think that leaving with no deal is an extraordinarily dangerous thing to do, which is likely to affect adversely every man, woman, child in the country.
Also, a Gambian soldier has admitted involvement in the killing of about 50 African migrants on the orders of the former president, Yahya Jammeh. Also in this podcast, the illegal practice of sex-selective abortions has been thrust into the spotlight in northern India. And scientists are warning that the next 18 months will be a crucial period for dealing with global warming. So, Boris Johnson will be Britain's next Prime Minister after two-thirds of the Conservative Party membership voted for him. He officially takes over from Theresa May late on Wednesday. President Donald Trump was quick to praise Mr. Johnson.
We have a really good man who's going to be the Prime Minister of the UK now, Boris Johnson. Good man. He's tough and he's smart. They're saying Britain Trump. They call him Britain Trump. And people are saying that's a good thing. That they like me over there. That's what they wanted. That's what they need. That's what they need. He'll get it done. Boris is good. He's going to do a good job.
President Trump. EU leaders have also welcomed the new leader, but they've not shifted their stance on the Brexit deal he hopes to renegotiate. The European Commission's incoming president, Ursula von der Leyen, has warned of challenging times ahead. Here in the UK, there was praise in the Conservative heartland of Ely in the south of England.
Very pleased.
Very pleased.
Very pleased indeed. Get in there, Boris. We're waiting for October the 31st.
I'm British. I don't want to be tied to the French, the Germans or everybody else. We don't know what life's about. They think everything's easy, don't they? Just pay and give
we
it to them.
We want our own laws. Our own laws back.
Yeah. It's a wonderful thing for the country and for Brexit. And Boris is a very positive person.
Absolutely.
And we really need positivity at this moment in time.
But Boris is the man we want.
So just who is Boris? With his unruly shock of blonde hair and gift for memorable phrases, Boris Johnson is the only politician in Britain to be known mainly just by his first name. Our political correspondent Rob Watson has this assessment of a man who's already been a newspaper journalist, Mayor of London, leader of the Brexit campaign and former Foreign Secretary.
Thank you. Well, thank you. There's only one way to get this country off the hamster wheel of doom, and that is to get Brexit done by October the 31st.
That was Boris Johnson's pitch to Conservatives during the just-concluded leadership contest. But who is the man who wants everyone to somehow start cheering up and believing in Brexit? In many ways, he's deeply conventional. He was educated at Britain's most exclusive private school, Eton, and at Oxford University. In other ways, he will surely be the most controversial occupant of Downing Street in living memory, given what his many critics and even some supporters would concede as his history of untruthfulness and untrustworthiness as a journalist and a politician, not to mention persistent doubts about his temperament and capacity for hard work. Sonia Purnell is author of a highly critical biography of Mr. Johnson, Just Boris, A Tale of Blonde Ambition.
The concerns about Boris Johnson go way back until the 1990s when he was reporting on the EU for the Daily Telegraph. That's when I was working with him. The concerns were about the truth or lack of it in some of the stories he wrote about the EU. Since then, of course, he's been Mayor of London. He arrived to a sort of great chaos in City Hall. And then, of course, he went on to become Foreign Secretary, thought to be one of the worst Foreign Secretaries for many years. These problems with him really go back a long way and were even highlighted by the Court of Appeal. An injunction had been sought to prevent coverage of his love child with an art consultant. And in the judgment there, they said that his recklessness when it came to other people's interests and well-being was such that they really did question whether he was fit for high office.
We vote leave on June the 23rd, we can take back control of £350 million a week.
But Mr Johnson is undoubtedly a very persuasive and sometimes charismatic politician who was instrumental in leading the campaign to leave the EU in 2016, although doubts persist to this day whether he actually believes in it. Gitto Harry has known Boris Johnson since student days in Oxford and worked for him when he was Mayor of London and has this take on his positives.
Boris has a huge passion for people, and I think people sense that. And that, coupled with this exquisite command of many languages, means that using a sort of turn of phrase and the power of persuasion, he can think outside the box and achieve what seems politically impossible or beyond most conventional politicians.
And top job? Is he the right person for that?
If Boris was to govern the UK as he ran London, as a liberal, one-nation conservative, pragmatic, open to all communities, coupled with his irrepressible belief that the UK is the best country on earth, then he could be a very successful Prime Minister. But there's an if there.
Certainly as Prime Minister, Mr Johnson won't have it easy, not least because of all the questions likely to persist about his character and past controversial comments, such as likening Muslim women wearing the niqab to letterboxes and bank robbers. As Foreign Secretary, it was a problem he frequently faced when questioned by journalists. Standing alongside his US counterpart John Kerry, he had to answer this.
You've accused the current US President Barack Obama of harbouring a part Kenyan's, quote, ancestral dislike for the British Empire, unquote, while claiming, I think untruthfully at the time, that he didn't want a Churchill bust in the White House. You've described a possible future U.S. President Hillary Clinton as someone with, quote, dyed blonde hair and pouty lips and a steely blue stare, like a sadistic nurse in a mental hospital, unquote.
I'm afraid that there is such a rich thesaurus now of things that I've said that have been one way or another, through what alchemy I do not know, somehow misconstrued, that it would really take me too long to engage in a full global itinerary of apology to all concerned.
Mr Johnson tends to breezily dismiss questions about his past utterances and writings, but undoubtedly his time in Number 10 promises to be lively. But what kind of Prime Minister will he be? Can he save Brexit as he promises, or will it all end in disaster? A question for George Parker, the political editor of the Financial Times.
I think it's hard to see how he delivers Brexit, but nevertheless, he's promised to do it by October the 31st, do or die. If he doesn't succeed, there are a lot of people in the Conservative Party who will be lining up to bring him down, and he could go down as one of the worst and shortest-lived British Prime Ministers in recent times. And he's going to run into exactly the same problems that Theresa May ran into in Brussels in terms of trying to renegotiate the deal. I think the House of Commons will continue to block a no-deal exit. The parliamentary arithmetic hasn't changed. And he will become Prime Minister in possibly the most forbidding domestic circumstances of any Prime Minister in recent history.
Many Conservatives have backed Mr Johnson more in hope than expectation. One told me supporting Boris Johnson was like rolling the dice and praying you get two sixes rather than snake eyes. Another senior Conservative famously once described Mr Johnson as the life and soul of the party, but not the man you want driving you home at the end of the evening. Now the whole country is in the car.
Rob Watson. During the campaign, Mr Johnson promised to renegotiate Britain's withdrawal agreement with the EU and get rid of the Irish backstop, which provides legal certainties over the flow of goods and people across the Irish border. He said he'd renegotiate a new withdrawal deal by October the 31st or leave without one. Do or die, says the new PM, but he'll come to power with a majority of just two. Jacob Rees-Mogg, a prominent Brexiteer, believes Boris Johnson can deliver.
What can he do differently? Well, the whole approach is different. Boris believes that Brexit is an opportunity to be embraced, not a problem to be minimised. And that looks for an outward-going Brexit, one where taking back control is an exciting thing to do, rather than something that you need to limit. So that resets the negotiations in a very positive way from a British perspective.
But specifically, how do you get through the no backstop problem?
Well, the issue there is one of the EU's own making. They decided they wanted a backstop. They will face a choice as to whether they want all the other things that are available. Citizens' rights are a very important one, and will grant it unilaterally if necessary. But does the EU want to settle citizens' rights? If it does, then it will have to look at a new form of agreement. So there are things in this for the EU too.
Jacob Rees-Mogg. But others in the Conservative Party are vehemently opposed to a no-deal Brexit. Mr Johnson's fledgling premiership has already seen several resignations from the government before it's properly begun. The senior Conservative MP, Dominic Grieve, has been outspoken about trying to prevent the UK from leaving the European Union without a deal. A year ago, he said if Boris Johnson became Prime Minister and leader of the Conservative Party, he would leave the party. Razia Iqbal asked him if he'll resign.
I think it's quite likely that will happen in view of the direction of travel that he's decided to take. But having chatted to my colleagues, I think the best thing I can do just at the moment is firstly to give him the space to develop his policies over the summer and to talk to my colleagues about the best way forward in trying to make sure that a no-deal Brexit is prevented.
And what are the mechanisms that you think are open to Members of Parliament?
There are a number of mechanisms open. It's possible that Parliament could enact primary legislation requiring an extension of Article 50 before we get to the 31st of October. But it's right to say that these things don't always work. And I'm very conscious that we may come to a point quite quickly. It might even happen in September where we actually get to an issue of confidence concerning the government.
And you would vote against?
I think it's perfectly possible that that could happen. Yes, because I've made my position very clear. I think that leaving with no deal is an extraordinarily dangerous thing to do, which is likely to affect adversely every man, woman, child in the country. And I'm not prepared to see that happen. So if it has become clearly his policy, and that is what he intends to do, then that will be the moment when I'm going to part company with him, and I suspect with the Conservative Party. I'll do it with great reluctance after 47 years membership, and I'll also try to do everything possible to avoid that happening by persuading him to take another course of action, because I think there are some other courses of action open for resolving this deep division within the party and the country.
When you say that you would do this reluctantly, in your view, how many people are there that might put country before party, as it's now being referred to?
I think on the evidence of my conversations, there are enough people to mean that the government would not command a majority in the House of Commons on a confidence vote. Of course, you can't predict, because people will have all sorts of different pressures, and indeed, rightly, different issues will crop up in their mind as to whether it's the right thing to do at any given moment. But I do think that it's pretty plain that there are a large number of Conservative MPs who think that a no-deal Brexit is peculiarly damaging, and will so damaging that it's something that we're not prepared to countenance.
Boris Johnson is famously a man for whom cynicism seems to go through his veins. I mean, he will change his mind. People have talked about him as being opportunistic. How much do you think you can change his mind, given how entrenched his position is currently?
I hope we may be able to point him in the direction of how to resolve this. I'm the first to accept that the result of the 2016 referendum, partly his doing as well, I don't think we should forget that, has been to plunge this country into 3 years of continuous crisis. And the crisis is hugely divisive. It's quite obvious. It doesn't matter where the majority lies at any given moment, because it's quite clear the country's divided down the middle. There's a risk of the Union of the United Kingdom breaking up. It's that serious. And we have to find a way of trying to get through this to an acceptable solution. The difficulty is that the solutions he keeps on putting forward, and indeed the present Prime Minister's put forward, have never succeeded in being acceptable. This is why I'm a supporter of a second referendum. It's not that I want a second referendum, but I actually think if we had a second referendum, if people were given the informed choice, because it's now pretty plain what's going on, between remaining, leaving with a deal, or even no deal Brexit, I think that that would bring this issue to an end. It would certainly bring it to an end for me, because if people voted to leave with no deal, I'd never mention the matter again. I just have to accept that that is it, even though I think it's a bad idea. But what I'm not prepared to do is to drag the country, or contribute to dragging the country into a no deal Brexit without such reference back to the public.
The Conservative MP, Dominic Grieve. Can Boris Johnson unite the Tory party and the country? And what is his Brexit plan? Here's our political correspondent, Rob Watson, again.
Well, I'm not sure that he will when it comes to his party or the country. I mean, to take the country first, he used to be one of those rare politicians in the UK who could reach across the political divides. But because he is so closely associated with the Brexit campaign, with the Leave campaign, and because the country is so polarised along those lines, I think he already starts with a massive handicap with the voters generally. As to his own party, well, I'm not sure he will or can reunite it. Well, I know how he'll try. He'll try to do it by saying, look, if we don't come together, we'll allow in a far-left government led by Jeremy Corbyn.
So, Rob, what about his cabinet? Will it be one of Brexiteers or will it be this unity cabinet which will include Remainers?
The short answer is we simply don't know yet. I think it'll be interesting to see whether the senior ministers in the cabinet are all believers in Brexit and indeed believers in a no-deal Brexit. But I think actually doubts have to remain about what Boris Johnson really thinks rather than who's in his cabinet, because let's not forget all the agonising he did before the referendum. Should he campaign for Leave? Should he campaign for Remain?
So what is his Brexit plan? Why should he succeed where Theresa May failed?
I mean, largely when Boris Johnson talks about Brexit, it's all about belief, about optimism. Let's stop being gloomy. We haven't had the detail, but to the extent that we have, it seems to consist in this idea of trying to renegotiate a deal with a withdrawal arrangement with the European Union, in particular to get rid of what's known as the backstop. That is this idea that Britain should stay close to the European Union in terms of customs and regulations in order to avoid a hard border in Northern Ireland, unless some other agreement comes up. And that if all of that fails, that Britain should be prepared to leave the European Union without a deal at all.
Rob Watson, talking to me earlier. Coming up in this podcast, a new immigration law is introduced by the Trump administration.
No judge, no jury, no appeal. Just the say-so of an immigration officer will be enough to take you away from your home and your family.
We hear from those who oppose it. A Gambian army officer has accused the former president, Yahya Jammeh, of ordering the murder of a journalist in 2004. The allegation was made during testimony to the nation's Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Our Africa editor, Will Ross, told me more.
Yes, well, these were quite dramatic revelations at the Truth Commission in the Gambia. And this Lieutenant Malik Jatta, who was a member of former President Jammeh's elite guard, known as the Junglers, he said that along with two colleagues, he was given an order, which he said was from the then President Jammeh, to go and kill the journalist Deda Haidara, who was killed in 2004. And ever since then, it's been a bit of a mystery as to what happened to him. He was a prominent critic of the former president. And the testimony from the man was in sort of quite stark detail, talking about the journey that they made in this vehicle across town and then shooting the man dead on the orders, he said, of Jammeh for a fee. Well, he said he was paid $1,000 for the hit.
And Mr. Jammeh, I mean, he's previously denied any government involvement in that murder, hasn't he?
He basically, when he was in power, he denied everything he was accused of. And interestingly, in the last few hours, the same soldier has also alleged that he was part of an execution of some close to 50 migrants who President Jammeh at the time, perhaps in paranoia, had said that they had come to overthrow him. So it seems there's another, you know, plot that involves the former president with the killing of these some 50 migrants who were found. You know, it's widely thought that they were trying to make it to Europe. They were rounded up and executed. The former president Jammeh denied everything, and he was accused of some terrible atrocities during his 22 years in power.
And will there be any prosecutions, do you think?
Well, that will depend really what the outcome of this Truth Commission is. It's supposed to be running for 2 years. There are a lot of atrocities that have come up, and certainly most of the victims will be hoping that the former president is brought back from exile. He's in exile in Equatorial Guinea, but it's far from clear if he will come and face justice and ever have a day in court.
Will Ross. The illegal practice of sex-selective abortions has been thrust into the spotlight in northern India after official data revealed that none of the 216 babies born across 100 villages over 3 months were girls. The alarming statistic has prompted magistrates in the state of Uttarakhand to begin an investigation. Our South Asia regional editor, Eletra Naismith, reports.
The selective abortion of female fetuses has been banned in India for a quarter of a century now, but the practice remains commonplace. Why? Well, it's a country where parents often see boys as earners and girls as costly liabilities. India is one of the world's fastest growing economies, but many millions remain desperately poor, particularly in rural areas. Many believe they just can't afford to give birth to a girl. Developments in technology mean mobile sex selection clinics can drive into almost any village or town. It's turned a back-alley business into a multi-million dollar industry. A government report last year found that about 63 million women were statistically missing from the country's population simply due to a preference for male children. It's skewing India's gender demographic. Men in some areas travel thousands of kilometres to find a bride. The government has been forced to take action.
मेरी एक ढाई साल की बेटी है और अगर मेरे को दूसरी भी बेटी होती है तो मैं उसको भी उतना ही प्यार.
Meera, not her real name, says Indian society needs to change its mindset. She has a daughter, she says, and will love her next child regardless of whether it's a boy or a girl. Meera is from Haryana. 12 districts with the worst sex ratios in India are here, which is why it's taking part in Beti Pachao, Beti Pahao, Save the Daughter, Educate the Daughter, a government scheme launched by Narendra Modi in 2015. It aims not just to promote education for girls, the mothers of the future, but to put declining child sex ratios at the centre of a public conversation. Education and empowerment are key. States where women have better land and property rights do show a comparatively better sex ratio. But bringing about change will be a long process. And as the shocking statistic from Uttarakhand shows, the battle rages on.
Eletra Naismith. The US government has introduced a major change to the country's immigration system. The authorities are bringing in a new fast-track deportation process that will bypass immigration courts. Under the new rules, migrants who can't prove they've been in the US continuously for more than 2 years may be deported immediately. Until now, that could only be applied on two conditions: if people were detained near the border and had been in America for less than 2 weeks. Human rights groups say hundreds of thousands of people could be affected. Omar Jadwat is director of the Immigrants' Rights Project for the American Civil Liberties Union.
What the Trump administration is trying to do here is find a way to deport immigrants who are living in the United States without providing any due process at all. No judge, no jury, no appeal. Just the say-so of an immigration officer will be enough to take you away from your home and your family and deport you from the country if they think that you've been living here for less than 2 years. That's not consistent with the rule of law. That's why we're going to sue them over it and work to stop it very quickly.
But in the meantime, could immigration authorities actually begin these deportations under these new guidelines?
Yeah, so we are obviously looking very closely, in touch with a lot of people around the country to monitor exactly that. We have not yet heard any reports of them actually using this new authority that they're trying to give themselves, but that's obviously something we're very closely watching.
If somebody's had 2 years to apply to get the right sort of papers, to get leave to remain inside the United States, and hasn't done so or been turned down, why shouldn't they be deported?
Well, first of all, the due process question is not about what the person actually did or didn't do. The due process question is, what chance do they have to even contest what the government's saying about what they did or didn't do? So if the government gets it wrong, if they've actually been here for 4 years, or if they, in fact, have some kind of status, they're not going to have a chance to say that to a judge. They're not going to have a chance to appeal to a court if the government gets their way.
Is it reasonable to say that this is not a particularly new move from this administration, but in fact, all it's doing is bringing into force a law that goes back to the mid-90s? It was, in fact, signed by President Clinton, Bill Clinton, which was intended to speed up removals in this way. It just hasn't been brought into force before now.
Well, the precise reason it hasn't been brought into force is because every previous administration has recognized that there are serious due process problems with applying this. The difference here is that the Trump administration is deciding to ignore those due process problems and to try to put this into force anyway. So it really is a change, and a significant change.
Omar Jadwat from the American Civil Liberties Union talking there to Tim Franks. The Swedish climate change activist Greta Thunberg has hit back at French legislators who boycotted her address in Parliament on Tuesday. The 16-year-old, who's inspired global protests by school students, said it was fine not to attend, but urged them to listen to science.
Some people have chosen not to come here today. Some people have chosen not to listen to us, and that is fine. We are, after all, just children. You don't have to listen to us. But you do have to listen to the United Science, the scientists, and that is all we ask. Just unite behind the science. Nothing.
And scientists are warning that the next 18 months will be a crucial period for dealing with global warming created by climate change. So far, France has recorded its all-time highest temperature. The mercury hit 42 degrees Celsius in the southwest of the country. I asked our science correspondent Matt McGrath if the current high temperatures here in Britain and other European nations are man-made.
Scientists would be loath to say that any particular singular event was caused by climate change. You can't rule out natural variability. But the research that's been done last month in June, which was the hottest June on record, 9 of the 10 hottest Junes have been in the last 9 or 10 years. Researchers carried out some research work on that month, and they indicated that the chance of a heat wave in June was made 5 times more likely by climate warming, global heating as we're seeing it. And it's likely the same situation is happening again this month or these few days now. One of the things that scientists say is that when you get this influence of humanity, human fingerprint on climate change, on the weather, you can get runs of these. You can get a couple of heat waves following on a heat wave with little break in between them. That's one of the things that they're thinking we'll see more of as time goes forward.
And the consensus seems to be now that the next 18 months are vital. Why?
There's a great sense that something must be done. And the UN process has chundered along for years, not delivering very much. The one thing it has delivered is the Paris Climate Agreement, which was signed in 2015. That becomes operational in 2020. One of the provisions of that is that countries must come back to the table by 2020 with an improved offer on what they're doing. Taken against the background of the scientists saying, look, if we want to keep global temperatures to 1.5 degrees a century, we need massive carbon cuts by 2030. Governments tend to act in 5- and 10-year cycles. The focus is that by 2020, those plans to cut carbon must be on the table or we won't make that deadline. There's real clarity and real pressure about that.
And what if nothing's done?
Emissions have come down. Countries are producing more of their energy from renewable sources. Things are changing. But the question is, will they change quickly enough? And that's what scientists are really worried about. The worry is that if we don't get those changes in place, we're heading for a world that will not warm at 1.5 degrees or 2 degrees, it will warm at 3 degrees. And the conditions we will see then would make what we're experiencing right now seem like a walk in the park in term, and that's what the scientists really believe.
Matt McGrath. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.